I'm Lisa Rosenbaum, and this is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. This season, I'm exploring the quiet revolution in medical training. I can't pinpoint the precise moment I decided to write a series of articles about medical training, but definitely one motivating force was that I started noticing arguments on Twitter, often among trainees, about whether medicine is a job or a calling. This is an age-old debate that I'm not sure I find that interesting in and of itself, just because how you treat your work is a personal choice, so there's really no right answer. But what I found super fascinating is how angry many trainees seem to be when people argue that medicine is a calling. That seemed like a change to me and something that we should be paying attention to. And I wanted to understand why. So I reached out to Dr. Dua Abdelhamid, who's a fourth-year dermatology resident at UT Southwestern in Dallas, planning a career in medical dermatology. We met when she was doing the medical part of her training at Brigham and Women's Hospital and have had lots of conversations since about a bunch of stuff, including about some of the challenges in our training environments. So because Dua became part of the cohort that trained, at least partly, during the height of the COVID pandemic, which obviously contributed to changing attitudes about work across our entire society, I asked Dua what it was specifically about COVID that seemed to kind of turn up the temperature on the job versus calling debate for trainees.
Our cohort was really unique in that we started residency before the pandemic and we're working through it. So we saw the before and then we saw the after. And the before was glorious, at least, you know, where I trained, it was amazing. And, you know, the social aspect of residency, the learning opportunities, you know, the volumes were manageable. It was a busy hospital, but it was nothing like what we experienced during the pandemic. And then all of a sudden, everything kind of flips upside down and there becomes a lot of, obviously, fear of the unknown. And then the added component of feeling like your institution might not care about you as much as they should. It felt like now trainees were kind of pitted against systems, pitted against, you know, even people on the same floor as you. It felt like there was increasing animosity with some of the other staff, including nurses. And it was just a very strange, uncomfortable, awful time. And I think that led people to really question when you're faced with potentially death. And at the time, really, we really had no idea. Like, everyone was dying from COVID. And I was very concerned about, you know, my parents, myself, etc. Like, it wasn't just like, oh, it's just COVID. So at the time, there was so much fear. And you really have to ask yourself, like, is this something that I'm willing to possibly die for and die from? And I think when people are pushed to that point, you really start asking, if it's a calling, then the answer is yes. If this is just a job, then absolutely no, this is just a job and I come first. And I think that pushed a lot of people to kind of have to make that decision.
Okay, but now the pandemic, at least in terms of healthcare workers feeling like they're risking their lives, has in a lot of ways receded. But it seems like a lot of this disillusionment or this decision that medicine should be a job remains. So what do you think that's all about?
We continued for months and months and months being deprived of our, you know, support systems and just still having these feelings that were kind of never addressed. And so you have a lot of time to kind of let that sink in. And that decision kind of becomes part of you. Like, those feelings become part of you. It's like, it wasn't just one fight. Like, this was the fight, you know, like when you're a partner and you have like a tiff. No, this was like the fight. I don't think we can come back from this fight. It's kind of like, I think it's once you see that, you can't unsee it. I don't know what it is. I've been blaming it on Gen Z forever, but that's obviously not accurate because it's a lot of millennials just like myself who, in my age group who might have this kind of this idea and this opinion that, hey, this is just a job. We're done. We're finished. I think COVID just showed you a lot of ugly truths about the system. A lot of patients died. It showed you just how unfair and how racist our system is. And it makes it really hard to want to operate within that system and give it your all. And then it sticks with you. And you kind of just want to get out of the whole thing. And the way to do that is to say, this is a job. I have no emotional connection to this anymore. I'm just going to do what I need to do to keep my job. And then I'm going to clock out at 6 p.m. and go home and try and recover from whatever trauma I experienced that day.
I'm wondering now, as you are a senior resident, if you observe a cultural shift in terms of how we set expectations, or even if part of what's happening is that, like, people who weathered the storm are transmitting new cultural norms to younger people. And maybe like that transmission is also colliding with what you also pointed out, where like Gen Z values, which are not, you know, essentially not to make work the center of our lives.
There really is a very noticeable shift. And I don't know if it comes from, hey, I had so much trauma with, my experiences that I just don't wish that for you. So I want to impose something else going forward. Or if it comes from, I want to treat this like a job. So you need to treat it like a job in order for me to feel okay treating it like a job. You know, that I think is a huge component. If not everybody's on the same page, then I look like a slacker and I look like a terrible person who is here for the wrong reason. So we all need to be on the same page about when it's time for sign out, you are going to leave. Because then that makes it okay for me to leave at 7 a.m. the next day or whenever the shift ends. So I think that's a huge part of it too, is it needs to be like a collective movement and people recognize that. Because it doesn't feel good to leave as soon as you're allowed to when the rest of your team stays hard and works late. So maybe that's why we're kind of pushing for that culture, is also because we need it ourselves. And I'm not sure. I've definitely been on the other side of that, though, where I've had experiences where when I was earlier on in my training, I've had seniors say, I'll take care of this. Even though, you know, I've offered and I'm like, that's not your shift, you know, let me do it. And, then it reminds you, it inspires me. I'm like, gosh, you know, it really is not that big of a deal to work this weekend for someone because they've got all this other stuff going on and I have nothing going on. Or like my co-resident is pregnant and she does not look well and I'm not doing anything. And I kind of enjoy this most days when I don't have to think about all these bad things that they do to us. So why don't I just stay and take care of this? So that, you know, I think we're so easily influenced, and so the culture really does matter, but I don't know who determines what kind of culture exists in a program and where that stems from. I think it really is people need to feel like everyone is doing what they're doing, because medicine very much is a hard-working group of people, and so I think it's very difficult for people who are traditionally very hardworking to make decisions to consciously not work as hard. I think that's super hard for people, and you don't want to feel judged for that.
So a lot of residencies have moved towards shift work, which means a new team may come in late afternoon or early evening, depending on the program, to replace the day team. And those coming in seem to think that their job, quote unquote, is to get the day team out of the hospital, to the point that some people who may want to stay told me that they feel pressure to either pretend they're leaving or go somewhere else to write their notes. But inevitably, patients get sick during the sign out or they need urgent attention. And I heard that when this happens, it's not uncommon for the night or twilight resident to tell the day person to just go home and that they, the night person, would take care of the patient. So do you think that's a problem for us to be telling trainees to leave if there's something wrong with their patients?
Well, I think certain things are okay. So I'll you know, give you this instance. It was like my first month ever as a second year IM resident. So I'm leading this team. I'm super nervous about it. And I want to be like the mom of the team. But obviously, I want to just also take excellent care of my patients. But I want everyone to feel amazing on my team and to feel supported. So one of my interns, his parents were in town for his birthday and he really didn't tell me. And we're staying there. We're all there after 4. Nobody left at 4. It was the beginning. It was like July. Nobody's leaving at 4. We all were staying there and, you know, working on notes. And he happens to kind of like mention that casually, like he's doing something with his parents tomorrow. And then I was like, oh, when are they getting in? And he was like, oh, they're actually here right now. And that I was like, this does not really align with Mama Bear Dua team vision. Like, I've got to let him go. And in that case, I think if it was just notes, you know, which I was so excited to never have to write a note again. But at that moment, I was like, I will write all your notes, like your remaining notes, you need to go hang out with your parents. That I think is fine. If it's situations where it's just like clerical work or, you know, all this quote scut, unquote, it might be, yeah, it probably is different if there's a clinical change, like we need to go together. If you had something going on, I think it's case by case. But if we're both around and something happens to the patient that we're all taken care of, we will go together and sort that out. That's kind of, you know, what we do, even if it's after our shift. That's kind of been how I've approached that. If it's something that's meaningless and not adding anything to your life and you're still here doing it, I don't think we all have to suffer doing that together. I really don't believe that. The scenario that you mentioned, that is a difficult one. I really don't know that I think it would depend. I don't know that I would have been like, you go home, I'll take care of this. But also I have done that because, again, I feel like I'm the one, in, you know, who's responsible. So you go home, but am I damaging or hurting or taking away a learning opportunity from someone on how to manage like a deteriorating patient or how to do that assessment? I probably was, but I thought I was being a good team leader by doing that and absorbing some of that. So I think that's the difficulty. That's a hard scenario.
Well, I think that actually helps a lot because I think so much of this is getting all of us back on the same side. So I think when we frame it as do a mama bear, like I love thinking of it like that, which is that like the senior residents are really, they see themselves as taking care of the patients, but they also are trying to take care of the trainees. And maybe that's because the trainees aren't feeling cared for by us. And so if we can frame it like that, I think it begins to illuminate some paths forward, like that we need to do a better job making trainees feel cared for. We need to think about how the culture is being passed on. And we need to think about like this hierarchy of care, it sounds like. And also, I think to do that, I think we have to start to recognize that, you know, as nice as it is to go home, that if we try to compress all the work into this shift that it ends at four, then like by definition, the fun things, which, and I would say that like taking care of a sick patient, it's not like normal fun, but it's doctor fun, you know, that gets cut out. And so I think then we get trapped in this cycle where work feels progressively less meaningful. And so I think it actually really helps to like get into the mindset of how trainees are thinking, because it makes it very clear that the intentions are still around care. It's just the care is being directed toward the other trainees as opposed to like all of us caring for the patients.
And it's all so interwoven. You know, there are certain things where you're like, obviously this is going to be way harder than other jobs. And that's what I signed up for. And I want to do that hard work because I really believe in what I'm doing. But it really comes down to what you believe about what you're doing. So if you really believe this is just a job, nothing you say to me about working hard is going to resonate. I don't actually want to do it. I think you're just manipulating me so I can work harder for you so you can profit and benefit. And so I think it's really because we think of it as like now a corporate thing, as opposed to a calling and something that you're just meant to do that requires hard work and sacrifice, which sometimes has been used to manipulate people. So I understand that. So you're right. I'm kind of right in the middle of all this.
Dua's response made me wonder what we can do to break this cycle. And maybe part of where we seem to be stuck is that in our quest to lead more balanced lives or improve well-being, we started to lose sight of the importance of some discomfort to our learning and growth. Being a doctor often is uncomfortable. Like you are in situations so often where you're making impossible decisions, where you're tired, like that physical fatigue never goes away, where people are mean to you because humans are human and they're vulnerable and they're sick. And that is inherently uncomfortable. So then the question becomes like, how do you set expectations around discomfort as the culture shifts gradually toward a profound intolerance toward discomfort?
I think I don't know how to answer that. And I don't know. And I think people have different levels of tolerance, but I think there is like a baseline certain amount of discomfort that you should be expecting in medicine. And people know that coming in, but then I think things change when you actually experience it because it's uncomfortable. It doesn't feel good. It feels awful. And so why should I be feeling like this if it's just a job? So I really think it comes back to this job calling thing. If this is just a job, I don't need to be dealing with this. But if it's my calling, then there's a lot more discomfort that I'm going to put up with because I feel moved by something much deeper than, you know, my paycheck, which is squat and residency. You know what I mean? And so I struggle with that and I don't know where to draw that line. And because it's so personal for everyone. Some people are really, really made uncomfortable by something that others might not be. And so it's kind of difficult to to say, hey, that's actually not an abusive situation. This happens to everyone. You know, move on from it. I think today you absolutely cannot say that in medicine. It's not seen as, you know, as PC. And it's also just not a great practice, right? Because we're dismissing people, but it's hard. You can't really, again, things are not weighted the same. Discomfort weighs differently for everyone. And that's what I think is so difficult about this. And again, it elicits a sort of respect and a blanket reaction that you have to, you know, impart and participate in. But it's hard if you are not buying into that or believing that, hey, this actually really was, you know, abusive versus just a little discomfort that's associated with training. If you think it's just a little discomfort that's associated with medical training, you feel awful and resentful when you have to change your behavior because someone said, hey, this makes me feel this way. You know, it's just such a weird, touchy topic. But what you said also about how in general, we all just don't want to be uncomfortable anymore. I really find that to be true. And I wonder if it's just because there was such a huge surge in the amount of discomfort that we all felt just the pandemic that it kind of used up all of our, you know, discomfort reserves. And now people just absolutely cannot. And I am one of those people too. I'm like, oh, I just can't deal with this. I'm not going to deal with this one particular aspect anymore. So I don't know. It's hard. It's hard because it's so personal. I think that's why.
Dua's not alone. I think lots of trainees and doctors feel like we used up all of our discomfort reserves during the pandemic. And so do workers across many professions. One of the biggest shifts we're seeing in society at large is a growing rejection of the notion that our work should be our primary source of meaning and identity. This shift has pragmatic implications for clinicians that I don't think we've begun to understand. Meaning, if we set firmer boundaries between life and work, how might this impact our patients? But as many of us reevaluate our relationships to work and think about whether it's better to go home, for instance, and let someone else take over, or go back to see a sick patient or have a tough conversation, these shifting attitudes also have implications for our well-being and sense of identity. If work becomes less central to our lives, particularly as doctors, does it automatically become less meaningful? And what elements are necessary to make work psychologically satisfying in the first place? We're going to get at some of these questions with David Bluestein, a vocational psychologist and professor at Boston College who studies the psychology of working. Bluestein has really been a pioneer in understanding work's role in our mental health and sense of identity. When it comes to the working lives of physicians and trainees, what are the key ingredients for being psychologically satisfied at work?
I do have a good sense of the work lives of physicians. It's not unlike the work life of a psychologist or a professor. We're folks who have been fortunate. We've had some privileges, psychological, intellectual privileges, as well as, you know, relational and social privileges and economic privileges that have allowed us to pursue a field that we have some passion for and a sense of purpose for. So the psychology of working would basically look at our work lives via the lens of to what extent does our work allow us to meet some fundamental human needs. And I developed a taxonomy of these needs, which were based on other taxonomies within psychology and organizational development. So essentially, there are three clusters of needs. The first one is to meet the need for survival and power, which certainly being a physician would meet those needs. I think of power not so much as, you know, a politician having power, but I'm thinking of it in terms of having agency in your life. The second cluster of needs focuses on social contribution and relatedness. So having a career that allows us to make broad contributions to the world, broad and specific contributions to the world, certainly medicine provides that. And it provides it in a variety of very deep and meaningful ways. The third cluster of needs falls under the rubric of self-determination, which comes from a motivational theory called self-determination theory. And the idea there is that if people have access to environments, and in this case a work environment, that provides them with a sense of autonomy, provides them also with the chance to develop competence, and also a sense of relatedness to others, they're more likely to feel authentically engaged in what they're doing. So those are the ways in which we think about work providing people with a sense of well-being.
So
I know you started out by saying that as a psychologist, you know, you're privileged and we are privileged as physicians. And I also know, however, that you're married to a pediatrician. So you have a familiar sense of how medicine does or doesn't meet these fundamental psychological needs. And I would love to hear what you've observed in your wife's working life in terms of where medicine seems to meet those critical psychological needs for work and where it's falling short.
Okay, yeah. I think, you know, in my position as the husband of a really amazing pediatrician, I could see how the work environment of primary care in particular, but I'm sure other fields of medicine, has become so infused with intense documentation demands and also with business models that no longer provide space and time or rewards for spending time with patients. It seems like the emphasis is on documentation, and often people will document while they're with their patients. I know my wife doesn't do that, which I think is becoming increasingly rare. My sense is that the business model of the field has shifted as we have moved toward this multi-insurance-based, quasi-free market of medicine. And I think that we've lost something along the way. And I could see its impact on my wife and others, her peers.
And so when you think about it within the needs that you've laid out to have psychologically satisfying work, in which area particularly are we falling short? And I think it's helpful actually to think about this as rigorously as we can, because we have all these well-being efforts in medicine that are like really dumb, honestly. Like, they don't work. Everybody makes fun of them all the time. And sometimes I like to think that if we could really like hone in on what it is that we're missing, that our efforts to remedy everybody's distress would be better.
Yeah, actually, psychology of working theory, and actually more specifically, self-determination theory, that motivational theory that we use, would identify two particular aspects of the working context that I think have been diminishing over the years. One is autonomy. So there's increasingly less autonomy in medicine. There's much more of a push to either see people really quickly or order more tests or order less tests. This is not necessarily my wife's experience. This is just kind of my own experience being in the world and kind of talking with other physicians as well. So I think the autonomy piece is important. And I think also the relatedness piece is important. And I think that increasingly, physicians don't have the time to spend with their patients, getting to know them, and also spend time with their colleagues. So I'm just going to go back in my own life history and think of doctors I've had. I could point to a pediatrician I had when I was a boy who had a profound impact on me through interventions. Basically, there were psychological interventions that really were transformative. And I always remember them, and it took him time to do these, to meet with my family, to spend time getting to know us.
Are you comfortable talking about what those interventions are? You don't have to.
Yeah, I could talk about it. So I had a period when I was younger where I was overweight. So I know we're in a period where people should be talking about their weight. This should be... And it was something that, you know, I was aware of. So the intervention, which, you know, this happened really in the 1960s, was what I would call a family-based systemic intervention now. So he called in my mom, and my dad wasn't there. It was an aunt who drove us. And he said, "Mrs. Bluestein, David is overweight, but it's not his fault. You are in charge." I was like 12 years old. "You're in charge of the food in the house. You're in charge of what he eats. And the family, the entire family needs to manage this. It's not, doesn't fall on David's shoulders." That was a liberating meeting.
I love that. And did it help you?
Tremendously, yes. The really important final end of that intervention is that I never became heavy again. It somehow liberated me from some aspects of my relationship to food that weren't very healthy. And at that point, moving forward, it was really transformative. And I always am grateful to this doctor. He took some time to talk to me and my family, and he did it in a very caring way.
It's interesting because there's an analogy within your story to, I think, how we think about well-being in medicine, which is I think a lot of people are feeling like the onus is placed upon them as individuals to fix a problem that is coming more broadly. So in your case, it was your family and your environment. And I think the same is probably true in medicine. But instead of fixing the system so that we have more autonomy, for instance, or more time for relatedness, we get emails, you know, about forest bathing on a Saturday or like doing a sleep module, which just makes everybody crazy. And I think, you know, given your expertise, it would be very helpful to hear you say how ineffective those types of interventions are likely to be. I think you could save the health system millions and millions of dollars because we are paying people, you know, chief wellness officers, offices of well-being. We do these endless surveys. If you could maybe just point out that that probably isn't what is going to solve our emotional distress.
Yeah, I think I could say it here with some conviction because there's empirical research in psychology and in organizational psychology where people study the impact of these, of changing organizational structures on the welfare of working people. And the research supports the self-determination theory, which is if you give people more autonomy, enhance their competence, which I think in medicine is where a lot of these trainings come in. And thirdly, allow them and foster relatedness in the workplace, people will feel better. It will require shifting some of the more intrusive aspects of the work environment. You know, mandates and incentives and disincentives for different ways of coding patients.
So I want to spend a little time trying to understand the pandemic's role in shifting workplace attitudes. We all know the pandemic changed our society's relationship to work in big and small ways. But what I want to focus on with you, given your expertise, is how COVID changed the psychology of work. Did it change the way we think about meaning and identity and where we ought to find those in our lives?
I would say that we probably don't have enough empirical data at this point to give an unequivocal response. But based on trends we're seeing at aggregate data, we certainly did see this great resignation phenomenon toward the tail end of the pandemic, of the intense part of the pandemic, because I don't think the pandemic's completely over. So we did see this great resignation part and then the quiet quitting phenomenon. Both of these did have some, you know, they were observed in aggregate data reports. I think we have seen, we are seeing a shift. I think it comes from a number of perspectives. One is the existential threat of COVID. I think that one of the adaptive aspects that Freud talked about in terms of defense mechanisms, it's not always adaptive, but somewhat adaptive, is denial. Like if we thought all the time about the different ways that, you know, we could die, it would be hard for us to go on. So we exercise some denial, you know, like driving on a highway. Like, you know, sometimes when I'm taking a bike ride and I look down at the highway, I think, wow, people saw from this view, they wouldn't be driving so confidently. So there's this piece about denial. I think the pandemic really broke down our denial about death. I mean, 1.3 million people died in the United States. That's quite a lot. So I think that's one part of it. So it does cause people to question, why am I working so much? I think a second aspect of it is, I feel like it has to do also with other changes that are happening in this decade. And I'm thinking about global climate change. I'm thinking about the sad emergence of really major wars, Ukraine, Russia, and Israel and Gaza. I think these wars are also causing people to rethink things. And I also believe another factor is that the workforce is the baby boomer workforce is aging out. Younger workers are becoming more prevalent. And I think there are some potential generational differences in how people look at work based on their generation, even though there's a lot of research data that suggests that we over-infer based on these generational differences. But I do think that values about work might be related to these generational differences.
I think that, you know, you raise these questions about existential threats, which I think in the end force us to refocus our priorities, I think, and, you know, war, climate change, spending all of your life, you know, giving to a job that many people feel doesn't love you back, etc. And I want to ask you a related question, because I think that's led to this like very common assertion that's baked into the zeitgeist right now, which is that we should not center our identity in work. There's a huge backlash to that. And I'm wondering if that's really truly psychologically bad to center your identity in work, or is it just part of shifting cultural norms that may one day shift again?
I think it's part of shifting cultural norms. I think that there's something healthy about people questioning this identification. The reality is, it doesn't have to be an either-or phenomenon. Those of us who have been fortunate to be able to really dive into something that we love, like medicine, or being a psychologist and an academic, those are, you know, for many of us, like, that's part of our hobbies as well. That's part of how we think of ourselves. I think what's happening, though, is that there's been some research and some really good journalism on this, is that Americans have kind of engaged in a relationship to work that's not always healthy. We have the shortest vacation time of most Western countries. We don't have enough personal time off. And then there's also a culture, I've heard this from other people within organizations, where people have like more personal time off. The culture is often not to take it because it looks like you're not dedicated. So I think the norms in our society that really value work over almost anything else, I think it's an important critique. I think people need to really not take for granted their relationships. Romantic relationships are really special, and they take time to nurture. So, you know, one of the thoughts I've had about this is, and this is an adage that a lot of us know, is that when people are dying, they rarely ask if they can kind of talk to their work colleagues. They want to talk to their family and loved ones and close friends. So that's an important piece of data for us. It's an important observation. We're relational creatures, and I think the extent to which over-identifying with our work identity gets in the way of relationships or developing other sorts of meaningful activities, in that case, I think people do need to find more balance.
Well, you're right. I mean, I think about the times that I, as a doctor, have gotten to be part of someone's dying process. I've never heard someone say, "I wish I had worked more." And I often hear people talk about regrets with family or, you know, lost loves, people they don't speak to anymore. So I think that for me is completely anecdotal, but I think you're probably right. I do want to ask you, though, because, again, medicine plays this unique role in society in that, you know, we're responsible for other people's health. And there's this question about where you draw the line. I think, you know, how you treat your work is a very personal choice. So I feel very strongly it's not my role to say that people should treat medicine like a calling or like a career or like a job. You know, that's up to them. And I also fully recognize that people's limits are necessary in response to the way medicine has changed and the sense that our employers, who largely now health systems, will extract as much work from us as possible. And many people, I think, feel necessarily then that they have to set limits. You know, I'm not going to be spending my entire weekend on my inbox, for instance, or, you know, taking extra call without reimbursement, things like that. But then you did mention quiet quitting, which is sort of an attitudinal shift. And it's not something that we have any data on yet in medicine. But I think it would be helpful to hear from you, because there have been like 100 million think pieces about quiet quitting, and I kind of got obsessed with it too. But what the psychology of quiet quitting is like, and how it might play out in a job like medicine, where not only for our patients do we sometimes need to go above and beyond, but going above and beyond feels good psychologically.
Yeah, I think quiet quitting is a form of resistance to work conditions that are becoming that increasingly encroach on people's lives. So I view it as a form of resistance, as a form of enacting one's feelings that this job has just taken up too much of my time and space. I think in fields like medicine or in fields like, you know, psychology, people doing mental health treatments, yeah, I think you don't really want to see quiet quitting in a way that's going to hurt patients. Or in my case, as somebody who also teaches, I don't want to engage in quiet quitting to a point where it will impact negatively on my teaching. So I think when we're serving other people, it is problematic. I think the place where quiet quitting can be really useful is this encroachment on our lives, like the whole culture of people sending emails and answering them on weekends. I have finally changed that behavior for myself, and it feels liberating. The other aspects of quiet quitting are people reformulating their relationship to work and trying to come up with a more balanced view. There's something to be said for a balanced view to work and family. There's a huge literature on work-family interface, work-family integration, and the research tells us that people who can come up with ways of integrating these roles are the ones who have the most satisfying lives.
I think David's onto something important. I always find it so valuable to think about how to apply expertise from outside of medicine to our own work environments. I also think it's kind of weird, given how much medicine values certain types of science, that we don't tap into the knowledge of people like David more often. Meanwhile, we spend millions of dollars trying to improve well-being. But although psychological science can give us a framework to think about what makes for satisfying work, it can't force us away from our computers or workrooms to take advantage of all the opportunities for meaning in medicine that remain. And sometimes I worry that if we treat medicine like a job, it becomes one. So I want to do his take of where she landed. So do you think medicine is a job or a calling now?
I think where I am right now at this stage in my life, in my training, I still do think it's a calling. I think what makes it feel like a job and pushes me to want to treat it like a job is all of the external pressures that take away, and a lot of it is, I think there, it has to do with capitalism, everything that takes away from me actually doctoring. So all the charting, all of the appeal paperwork, all of the prior authorization, seeing a patient in front of me and knowing that I have a medication that can help them, not being able to get it, not being able to get patients into clinic, you know, all these things make it feel like a job where, hey, if everyone else is going to not do their best for this patient, it's probably easier for me to also just dissociate and not be so invested because it's eating me up. And the system clearly doesn't want to help me. So I'm just going to clock out and go home. Never really been able to sustain that, although sometimes I try and talk myself into it, thinking that it'll be better for me. You know, I'll be a lot more mentally healthy if I can just dissociate and just leave work at work. But there's so many instances, you know, throughout clinic where I'm churning, and then I have a conversation with a patient about a new diagnosis for something, and we have a deep talk about it, and their eyes well up, and, you know, it's the first time that they've heard X about their diagnosis or even gotten a name for it, and then we hug, and I'm like, oh, this is why, and, you know, I feel called to do that. It's more than just, like, treating the disease. It's that level of connection that I've always wanted, and I feel, yeah, I just don't know where else you can get that.
Lisa Rosenbaum, This is Not Otherwise Specified, a podcast from the New England Journal of Medicine. On our next episode, we'll discuss the revolution's fallout for medical educators.
It shouldn't take somebody leaving their job and no longer having to fear consequences to talk about this, and that it's very telling that nobody's willing to talk about it on the record, because what that tells you is that's part of the brokenness of our system. No medical education professional should have to feel afraid of talking about these things, these challenges that we all share. We all love our students, all of us.
I'm Lisa Rosenbaum. This is Not Otherwise Specified, a podcast from the New England Journal of Medicine. Follow the reporting at nejm.org. Episodes drop every Wednesday. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.